How will we power our future? Can we create a healthy and clean economy? Climate One at the Commonwealth Club is at the forefront of the global debate about energy, economy, and the environment. Bringing together the brightest and most provocative leaders of our time, Climate One is the place where big ideas get heard. With thoughtful and insightful discussions on policy, business, science, and culture, Climate One founder Greg Dalton gets to the heart of the matter. It's our future. It's time to come together.
Todd Woody, Craig Miller, welcome to Climate One.
Thank you.
Thanks.
So transportation and electricity are a big part of the carbon equation and have attracted a lot of the venture capital investment lately. So Todd, tell us what some of the recent headlines have been in electric cars. Are they really ready for the mainstream?
They're hitting the road later this year in the Bay Area and elsewhere in California. In small numbers, but they're definitely ready for the road. And more importantly, the regulators are working very hard to get the rules of the road established by the end of this year.
Now, a lot of people, when they hear electric cars, you conjure images of go-karts and three wheels. Are these are going to be real electric cars?
These are real cars, and I've driven a number of them. They range from very tiny cars, small cars, to sedans.
So and we're talking about all electrics as opposed to the next generation of hybrids.
All electric cars.
And a lot of these companies are based in California. Tell us some of the ones that are getting the investment and how they might compare, so either the products or the models compare.
Sure. A lot of the action actually is happening behind the scenes. The companies are going to build the infrastructure so that you have a place to charge your car in when you go to the shopping mall or go to your office or even to your home. So companies like Better Place in Palo Alto, it's raised north of $400 million. Mm-hmm. And what they're doing is building the whole infrastructure of charging stations, battery swapping stations. There's other companies like that in the Bay Area. That's the stuff that has to be established first if this market's really going to take off.
But Better Place has a little different approach to this, right?
Yes.
They're the ones who want to swap out batteries rather than... how's that different from the other approaches to electric cars?
Competitors are focusing on building the charging stations. You can see it on the street or at a shopping mall. Better Place is doing that also, but what they're doing is if you want to take a longer trip, they all have battery swapping stations, sort of look like a gas station on the highway, and you'll drive in, a robot underneath a platform will come, take out your battery, swap it out with a new fresh battery so that you can get, say, from San Francisco to Los Angeles.
Buy some coffee and donuts along the way.
It's kind of interesting that a couple of years ago the governor stood up and said, we're going to build a hydrogen highway for the next generation of cars, and that's clearly not happened.
No.
But the electric thing is happening.
It is happening because the fuel already exists. We already have electricity. So with hydrogen, we needed to create a whole new infrastructure that would be extremely expensive. For electric cars, we still have to build an infrastructure of charging stations, but the power is there.
So the other model, rather than the swap out a battery, is that you have to sort of find a plug every so many hours, or I believe one of them, Fisker, for example, others have sort of electric, they're hybrids basically, they're not purely electric. What about the big companies? We know that GM is doing the Volt. Are the big boys playing in this, or is it startup driven?
Probably, it's on the automaker side, they're definitely in play. Almost every major automaker will come out with an electric car in the next couple of years. This year in California, you see the Chevy Volt, which is a hybrid. You'll see the Nissan Leaf, which is an all-electric car. They've been very aggressive. Ford's going to bring the Focus, electric version of the Focus, out in 2011. So there's going to be actually quite a lot of choices.
And when you mention electric car in California, a lot of people think of Tesla because our governor has been a cheerleader for Tesla. Their IPO is rumored to be happening. They filed for an IPO.
Yes.
It's said to be in June sometime. Is that going to be a big deal in the story of electric cars?
We'll see. I don't think there's going to be sort of a Netscape moment for electric cars or any green technology company because their success is so dependent on government policy and incentives. For instance, Tesla filed to go public immediately after they got a $465 million loan guarantee to build their next factory for their next model. Solyndra, a solar cell company in Silicon Valley, filed to go public immediately after they got a $500 million loan to build their next factory.
So that's where the stimulus money went, okay.
Yeah, right now, when I talk to venture capitalists and entrepreneurs, one of the first questions that venture capitalists will ask a startup company is, what's the status of your government funding? Mm-hmm. Are you likely to get a loan? Because that's become such a crucial part of getting going and going to market now.
VCs who want the government to stay out of the things except when they fund their
startups. This is playing out, too, in the whole RPS, or renewable portfolio standard targets that California has set up for itself, wanting to be one-third renewables by 2020. They're running into the same thing. The developers of these big solar farms, they go to their investors, and there are people lined up waiting to write checks as soon as they get permitted. But, they run into this chicken and egg problem. So, we need the money in order to go through the permitting process, which costs millions of dollars and takes multiple years. The investors say, why not? We're not going to bet on something that might go south.
And so what are some of the reasons that the permits take so long? And are we doing a good job of accelerating that process?
They're trying. But it's still described, even by the special advisor to the governor for renewables projects, as tortuous. And a lot of it has to do with all of the different agencies that have to be involved, all of the different laws that have to be adhered to. It's not just CEQA, or the
California
Environmental Quality Act. It's not just, something like the Energy Commission. It's very often a whole patchwork of, a dozen or more agencies that have to get involved. One of the problems is that when you're building out a solar farm or a wind farm, the footprint, the physical footprint of it is many, many times what it is for something like a natural gas plant, which maybe just you can put that on a few acres. But some of these solar farms are thousands of acres. And so the more land you have involved, then the more, the more things are required in terms of biological surveys, make sure that there are no, endangered species there. And if so, what are we going to do about it? And it takes months and months and years sometimes to get through it. There's I'm doing a story now with one solar developer who has had to bring in scat-sniffing dogs who have to then go over the entire, couple of thousand acre footprint of his proposed solar array to make sure that there are no kit foxes on the property.
The biological surveys alone can take years. I went down to one site where they spent hundreds and hundreds of hours looking for one particular species. In fact, I wrote a story for Fortune on one of the boom jobs right now is biologist. Is all these big solar power plants, which are typically being sited in the desert, which are home to a lot of endangered species. They have to go sometimes come in and do surveys for maybe a dozen different species. And sometimes the species only occur or can be found at certain times a year.
If they were going to remake The Graduate, the one piece of advice, the one word instead of plastics, at the cocktail party would be compliance.
Solar or So our environmental rules are an obstacle to solving this big environmental challenge.
Yeah, the rules were put in place to protect the environment, and these big solar power plants definitely have an impact on the environment. So the challenge here is how to balance these two things out, how to expedite permitting without doing something that's going to really hurt the environment, too, because these are, when it comes down to it, big industrial facilities.
And Todd, you wrote a story for the New York Times about a very secretive billionaire philanthropist who's also making some big bets here. Yeah. What's he doing?
He's a really interesting, David Gelbaum is his name. He's given away $500 million to environmental groups, including the Sierra Club and an organization called the Wildlands Conservancy, which has preserved about 1,200 square miles of California, including 500,000 acres of the Mojave Desert. When some of these projects started appearing in the Mojave, including on these lands that were later donated to the government, his group got Dianne Feinstein, Senator Feinstein, to introduce legislation to permanently protect those. He particularly believes that you shouldn't put big solar power plants in pristine areas, and he's made his big bets to the tune of $500 million on a lot of solar companies that are developing what's called distributed solar that you put on the rooftop, you put in your cities, on degraded
small
farmland.
Stuff, yeah. Okay, so he's making it, and a lot that got a lot of people upset in the industry who want to say, look, this is a place for solar. Turtles be damned. Really.
Well, I don't know if there's anybody saying that, but there are a lot of people saying, if we could just get the process down to a reliable 1 year time frame, just give us an up or down, yes or no, within 1 year, we'd be happy, our investors would be happy. But it's not quite playing out that way, unfortunately.
I was going to say, partly the onus is on the companies. They really need to make sure, before they choose a site, that they're not going to run into a huge species problem. Another issue I've written about is the water issue. Sure. A lot of these solar thermal power plants, they want to wet cool, which means they're using billion gallons of water a year or more in desert areas. And they've been forced basically to back off that now.
And there are people, I have talked to people mostly in the photovoltaic industry and the distributed who are targeting distributed energy, who think that that distributed generation is the answer, that we can, they sincerely believe that we can do it all, we can meet our renewables goals just with distributed power. But I would say they're in the minority. Most of the credible people that I've talked to think we're going to need it all. We're going to need utility scale installations of one sort or another, whether it's wind, solar, thermal solar, out in the desert or someplace in order to get there.
Because rooftop solar is one of the most expensive sources of power you can get, right?
It is, but prices declined about 40 to 50% last year. So that's totally changed the equation. You've seen this with the utilities. They've signed hundreds and hundreds of megawatts worth of deals in the past year for photovoltaic because they've seen these big solar thermal projects get bogged down in environmental disputes. So it's the equation has definitely shifted radically in just the past year.
Do we know about job creation? A lot of the economy is one thing, but what about jobs? Do we know if these things are creating jobs in California? Obviously, the big solar plants will create construction jobs, and let's talk about jobs.
Well, jobs for the build-out of the renewable energy systems, and the problem with the jobs component is that many of them are temporary. Most of the jobs involved in a solar array, for example, are involved in getting the place laid out and constructed, and then those people go home or they move on to do something else. It doesn't take very many bodies to permanently staff a solar array out in the desert or something. So what a lot of the companies are doing is that when they're making their pitch about job creation, they're actually using job equivalent type figures and analysis and multipliers to sort of pad the account a little bit, I think.
Thousands of jobs,
yeah.
But just for 2 years.
Yeah.
But the unions are really behind this because it could be 1,000 jobs for a 500-megawatt solar thermal plant for 2 years, but mm-hmm. they're hoping there'll be another one. And there's literally dozens of these in the planning stages. So it is short-term, but all construction jobs are short-term. So they're hoping this will add another segment to the economy with the housing collapse.
And something else you hear a lot of is that these are green jobs that cannot be exported, right. cannot be right. shipped overseas. But China has already surpassed us in manufacture, am I right, in manufacture of photovoltaic panels, for example.
Yes.
And so many of those jobs are already gone. And so the jobs they're talking about that can't be exported tend to be things like the weatherization jobs, the climate energy efficiency retrofitting jobs and the construction jobs.
And for residential and commercial solar arrays, installing on rooftops in neighborhoods, those jobs are here and those are expanding. I was talking to a founder of a company called Sungevity, and they had more orders in the month of March than they had the whole previous year.
And how about on the car side? Most of the startups are not based in Detroit. They're based here in California.
Yeah.
Fisker, Coda, Tesla, Better Place, they're all here. Are they creating jobs in California?
Well, Coda is a Santa Monica company, but it's basically its car is being built in China.
There we go. Okay.
So Tesla, yes, it'll be, well, it's right now the Roadster is built in England. The Model S, the next model, will be built here. So
by the way, what's the cheapest car in their lineup right now that you can buy?
For who?
Tesla.
Tesla? It's the Roadster at $109,000.
But the Model S, the sedan, I think is coming out in the 40s or 50s?
40s. They say 50s with the tax rebate. So, I mean, these companies are small startup. They will sell a very small number of cars, so we're not going to have huge job creation. But you are actually seeing the job creation is in Detroit from solar companies because they're turning to a lot of the manufacturing processes used in the automotive industry are perfect for solar manufacturing, for solar arrays. So there's been a number of companies that have set up operations in Detroit.
Another big debate going on, Craig Miller, is whether California has the right policies in place. And tell us about what's happening with the repeal of the Global Warming Solution Act, or AB 32.
Yeah, a lot of people have started to use the word repeal. There's a repeal campaign going on. That's not exactly
true.
It'd be more like a freeze campaign. There are a number of people who are very convinced that the law that California has had in place for about 3 years now, which is essentially the state's climate change strategy, is going to wreck the economy. And there seem to be two schools of thought on this. Either it's going to wreck the economy or it's going to save the economy. We just talked a little bit about all of the green jobs, that are being created. There's a lot of hype around that as well. But there are other people who think that it's just piling too much on businesses, particularly small businesses, too many mandates, too many costs at a time when, as one person put it, we have to dig ourselves out of the hole. So there's a whole campaign now to basically take this law known as AB 32, which is California's cap and trade program, and it has a lot of other components to it, and stop it in its tracks until the unemployment rate drops down to 5.5% and stays there. This is the state unemployment rate for four consecutive quarters. Now, that's something that that has only happened about three times, you know, in the last 30 years. It's about a once per decade occurrence when that actually happens. Right now, the unemployment rate in California is over 12%. And so that could, in effect, mean putting AB 32 on hold, the state's entire climate mitigation and adaptation strategy, or most of it, on hold for basically an indefinite period of time.
Yeah, so the environmentalists and others say it's basically to kill the bill, because once it goes dormant for so long, it may not come back. But to be clear, AB 32 hasn't really taken effect yet.
That's right. But the state does have about, according to the Legislative Analyst's Office, about $120 million invested in 3 or 4 years worth of getting it ramped up, just holding, you know, endless public hearings, developing regulations, taking the first comprehensive greenhouse gas inventory among industry in the state and that sort of thing.
Yeah, so laying the foundation. How's the governor responding to this? This AB 32 is kind of his legacy.
Well, the governor has said this is the work of greedy out-of-state oil companies, and he's going to push back. He's not going to allow it. But the initiative campaign to freeze AB 32 was able to raise, with a lot of money from out-of-state oil companies, more than two-thirds, I think, financed by these companies, nearly double the number of signatures they would need to qualify for the initiative. We won't hear until the end of June on whether they actually be certified, but I think there's little doubt that they will be certified. It's already a full-blown campaign. Both sides are armoring up with professional campaign strategists and communications people, and the battle lines have been drawn.
So, Todd Woody, the clean tech startups that you talk to, is this on their radar? Will this help, or where are they in this?
Well, I mean, there's no doubt. I mean, the venture capitalist community, the startups, they're all against this. But
against freezing AB 32?
Definitely.
Because their companies will benefit from AB 32?
Definitely. However, with small companies, they don't have a lot of money to spend on political campaigns. They typically don't get involved in political fights.
One of their groups, the National Federation of Independent Businesses, is one of the main bodies behind the campaign to freeze AB 32. So the business community seems to be split on this whole idea. Some of the green tech companies clearly that will benefit, they're in favor of keeping AB 32 in effect. There are other companies that have invested a lot of money over the last 3 years in just getting ready for compliance for a set of rules that has been in development. Now they're just saying, hey, somebody tell us what the rules are going to be. They're not quite sure which direction to run in. And then you have other businesses that are clearly opposed to it. If you run a cement mill, for example, you're going to be paying a lot of money in emissions permits.
And what would be the impact? There are other AB 32 is just a centerpiece of many climate laws that the state has passed in recent years on land use and tailpipe emissions, et cetera. So what would be the impact if AB 32 were frozen? Would the others go forward? And how big of a change would that be?
Well, all of the regulations would probably be frozen. Most of the regulations under AB 32 would probably be frozen until that finally lifts, when they hit the unemployment
rate
trigger.
For a very long time.
For a very long time. Now, it could happen anyway. There's already a provision in AB 32 that allows the governor at his or her discretion in times of extreme economic stress to suspend the whole thing for up to 1 year. Both of the leading Republican candidates, have already said they would do that. So it's quite possible that the thing might end up being suspended anyway.
Okay, so we wouldn't necessarily need this ballot initiative if a certain governor got it.
That's right. Wouldn't affect the renewable portfolio standard that requires utilities to obtain a certain percentage of their electricity from renewable sources.
That's right, yeah.
Tailpipe laws. There's lots of other tools in the
toolbox. The tailpipe emissions law, of course, after a long fight with the federal government, basically became the federal rule. So, yeah.
And let's talk about the federal rules briefly. Recently, there was a new climate bill introduced in the Senate. Mm-hmm. It's getting lots of play. Some environmentalists like it, some don't. A lot of businesses like it or don't. How's that going to play out, and how's that going to affect California here?
Well, here again, you know, there are actually two bills out there now. One almost forgotten, you know, that was passed by the House narrowly last year, and now the Senate bill, which has just been proposed recently. Both of these bills contain provisions that would either preempt or temporarily suspend carbon regulation at the state and regional level, specifically the cap and trade program under AB 32 that California has been trying to roll out in conjunction with a half a dozen other states and Canadian provinces. Under the Senate bill, the more recent Senate bill, that would they would simply pull the plug on that. Under the House bill, it would be suspended until 2017.
So is that to say that if a federal bill passes, AB 32 doesn't matter anyways?
Well, essentially, it either won't matter or it won't matter for a few years, depending on how things go. But basically, yeah, the businesses in general often decry this idea of a patchwork regulation.
Sure.
You know, they want one set of rules that applies everywhere, and so Even Mary Nichols, the head of the air board in California, who's kind of like the chief regulator behind AB 32, even she says we all want to see a federal program in place, but we don't want that program to undermine the state's rights to continue with their own programs. They're afraid that the federal programs will end up being not as stringent, quite frankly. And as one state official put it in a conference call with media, they're afraid that the federal rules will end up setting ceilings instead of floors.
Right. And California is known to be further lead the country rather than follow the country on these things. Right.
Right.
Right. Todd Woody, again, are the clean tech investors concerned about this? I mean, how much of their bets that they're placing on these big investments are betting on these kinds of policies?
I mean, in the long run, they're all betting that there'll be some kind of national climate legislation.
Price on carbon.
And they've actually spent a lot of time in Washington in a way they have not in the past. You see VCs in Washington, you've seen them in Copenhagen, so they've definitely they've realized they have to get involved. I don't think it's, affecting their decisions down to I'm going to invest in this company or not. But, I mean, the health of the whole sector definitely depends on this in the long run.
Certainty. Whether there is or isn't, they want certainty. Right?
What are the rules going to be? Just tell us. That's what a lot of them are saying.
Well, great. Todd Woody and Craig Miller, thank you for coming to Climate
One.
Thank you for having us.